Hello, everyone. Welcome to Better Health While Aging, a podcast that gives you strategies and tips about improving the health and well-being of older adults. We discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60, the best ways to prevent and manage those problems, and we also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory or even the quality of a senior's healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Leslie Kernison. I'm a practicing geriatrician, so that means I'm a medical doctor specialized in geriatrics, which is the art and science of modifying healthcare so that it works better for older people and for their families. In today's episode, I have a special guest. I'll be talking with Chris Langston, PhD, and for almost 20 years, he's worked in philanthropy to improve the health and healthcare of older Americans. For the last 8 years, until last fall, he was the program director at the John A. Hartford Foundation, whose work is dedicated to improving the care of older adults. And this is one of the most prominent funders in the health and aging arena. Through this work, Chris has been involved in a number of innovative projects related to improving the healthcare of aging adults, including new models of care delivery, health professional education, and national policy changes. So as you may know, philanthropy is actually a really powerful force in shaping the research agenda in academia and in nurturing innovations that can then be more broadly adopted for the benefit of the public. So I'm really thrilled that Chris was able to join us today on the podcast to share his insights on the health and aging landscape based on his many years working for major foundations dedicated to aging and health. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Leslie. It's a pleasure to be here. I subscribe to your podcast, and I enjoy it, and I enjoy podcasts in general, so it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm guessing that many in the audience have actually hardly thought about the role that foundations play in shaping health and aging. Can you tell us a bit about the Hartford Foundation and what it does?
It'd be a pleasure. So people absolutely don't know what the Hartford Foundation is. I think many people know something about things like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They're building a culture of health. You might have heard their messages on National Public Radio, or the MacArthur Foundation, building a lush, verdant world, peaceful world. The John A. Hartford Foundation is not as well known, and people often ask us about how the weather is in Connecticut or what our relationship to insurance is. But actually, John A. Hartford was one of the family owners of the A&P grocery store, back when that was a very big deal in groceries in America. And he left his ownership of the company, and his brother George did as well, to create this foundation, which started working in aging in 1982, which is 30 years before the leading edge of the baby boom began to turn 65. So it was quite a foresighted enterprise, and long before my time. But it's worked for 30 years plus now to try to improve the health of older Americans specifically.
So you mentioned that when they started, they were interested in aging. And did they then add health as a focus? Because that really seems to be a focus for the foundation.
That's a really good observation. There are funders who are interested in aging more broadly than health. For example, they're interested in continuing careers for older people, or art experiences for older adults. The Hartford Foundation's focus has always been on the intersection of aging and health. In fact, they had worked in healthcare more generally for many years before 1982, when they started working in aging and health, and they decided to focus in even more narrowly at healthcare for older adults starting then.
Well, since I'm a geriatrician, of course, I love to hear that. And in my training at UCSF, first for clinical geriatrics and then for my 3 years of research fellowship, I, of course, always heard a lot about the Hartford Foundation because they were funding some of the work being done at UCSF Division of Geriatrics and really at many other centers throughout the country. Can you just tell our audience a little bit about sort of how the foundation does its work? Because I think people don't always realize that they're there sort of working with these academic divisions and nonprofits.
Absolutely, be happy to. And I think historically, starting in 82, in fact, the Foundation's analysis of what the problem was in terms of the lack of good care going to older people was that health professionals didn't know enough about the special needs of older adults, the things that you're talking about on your podcasts. And so the philanthropic intervention, actually the first program in 82, was to begin to train educators in medicine around geriatrics. So we started a program, they started a program, to send academic educators, academic faculty members back for fellowship training so as to try to grow the number of faculty very rapidly. And they did that for, I think, 24 people, which doesn't sound like a lot, but many of them have become very important teachers and researchers in academic medicine and had a lot of influence beyond that. Over time, the foundation's programs grew and proliferated to spread beyond medicine, the training of physicians and psychiatrists, to nursing and social work, as we recognized that those were very important health professions as well in terms of the outcomes and care of older adults. And we also built up the number of different programs within each of those professions. So starting actually in 1997, the University of San Francisco was a center of excellence in geriatric medicine of the John A. Hartford Foundation, which meant that we sent them money every year to help support the training of fellows on faculty tracks so that we could increase the number of people available to influence other trainees in medicine.
So sounds like a big part of the work was addressing this need for clinicians to be trained in geriatrics or at least have access to right. teachers who could teach some geriatrics. Well, I'd love to talk more about that in a bit, but first, can you tell us just a little bit more about how you yourself came to be involved in philanthropy and how you ultimately came to focus on health and aging?
So like a lot of people, it wasn't anything that I had planned out for myself. Sometimes I like to say that I was kidnapped by gypsies, but that's not actually true.
It's a good story, though.
Yeah. I trained as an academic psychologist, which means I wasn't actually treating people, but doing research around well-being, quality of life. And I became interested in health as one of the outcomes of the different psychological processes that determine how good people feel about themselves in their lives. And I then had an opportunity after I was teaching and doing my own research for a while to go back to do a fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania and its partner, the Philadelphia Geriatric Center, to look at these kinds of psychological processes around stress and coping with life events in older adults. In the long-term care facility, as well as in people in the community. And what I found was that things that matter a little bit to you and me who are younger and living in our own homes matter enormously to the older adults. And so it's a population for whom the quality of care and the quality of life is tremendously important. And I got hooked in geriatrics and gerontology at that time. I happened to be commuting between New York and Philadelphia, and my first child was born, and that commute seemed really long, and I saw an ad in the newspaper for this outfit, the John A. Hartford Foundation, and I answered the ad, and before you knew it, I was working there.
And the rest is kind of history. Well, that's so interesting, you sort of commenting that that the things that maybe would be less important to people who were younger were really important to older adults. What kinds of things did you find? Can you give us a few specific things you found?
Well, I think, for example, the responsiveness that older adults have to the quality of their environment or the quality of their care is much higher. One of the things that you know as a physician is that people tend to get better in any event. So quality of care for people who have physiological reserve and life reserve is often not as important as for people who have less reserve. So making a mistake with a medication for a younger person might not even be noticed. Making that same mistake for somebody in their 70s or 80s could make them very, very sick. So the quality of the care that's delivered and the quality of the environment that people have becomes more important as they age.
Yeah, no, I agree. The, you know, in a lot of ways, the medical stakes and health stakes are higher as people get older. Mm-hmm. They both have more things going on and less innate ability in the body and mind to bounce back the way we tend to when we're younger. So at the Hartford Foundation, you in recent years seem to have worked quite a lot on assessing and improving the quality of healthcare. So that's another topic near and dear to my heart, since, as you know, I did part of my research fellowship focus on quality as well. And I thought it was really interesting, this poll you did a few years ago, where you tried to sort of gather some data regarding the quality of healthcare for older adults. Can you talk a bit about it, so about what the questions you asked and sort of what you discovered?
Absolutely. And I think this was one of the things that was really interesting to me, one of the things that most interesting to me across all our work, was really there's a dichotomy between the way people experience their healthcare, even older adults, and what they sort of think about it in general. So most people are very satisfied with their care. If you ask them, they said they're satisfied with their physicians, they're satisfied with their hospital stays. But when you drill in more and ask them whether they receive, for example, a full review of all of their medications, if, say, that their primary care provider, who's supposed to be coordinating all their care, knows all the other providers who are involved in care, they'll tell you no. No, though that didn't happen. That, and what you'll get is this, I think, disconnect between the overall satisfaction people feel about their care, which is actually pretty high, and the failure of care to really do some of these things that are really quite important, especially for older people. So in our first poll, we asked people about these sort of basic quality care for older adults, things that are actually part of a new benefit from the Medicare program called the annual wellness visit, that included things like being screened for being at falls risks, being screened for cognitive impairment, having your medications reviewed, having your primary care provider know the other professionals who are involved in your care. And we were able to show this very strong effect that people were, while they were quite satisfied with their care, they sort of had to admit that there were a lot of things that they weren't getting. And when we asked them after we'd gone through all these things that they weren't getting, they said, oh, well, maybe I'm not so satisfied. And in fact, maybe I would get better care if my health professionals knew more about geriatrics. So we thought that this really enabled us to see into one of the key issues is, in healthcare, is why isn't there more demand for geriatric expertise? Why aren't geriatricians in an aging society the most popular specialty? Why aren't people going into the field? And while there are lots of reasons for that, one of the reasons still is that there's not a lot of demand from people and families for this kind of expertise because they don't even know that it's out there.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also just, I mean, there's the expertise of the clinician, but that also there are just all these aspects of healthcare, especially for older adults, but in a way for any healthcare, that people often don't realize should be provided or are recommended. And I don't know, maybe it's a bit, you know, a combination of low expectations. And I mean, I find that people often, if they haven't been feeling super sick or unwell, or if they don't have a really burning concern bothering them, they go to the doctor, but they don't seem to sort of expect very much.
I think that's sort of the tragedy of low expectations. But also, healthcare is one of these areas where people are at a profound information disadvantage. They often don't know what they don't know. And let me just give you a sort of personal story, if you don't mind, I think that illustrates this. As you mentioned in your introduction, one of the things that older people are often worried about is falls. And this story really ties into that. So I was visiting my family in the Bay Area in the 2000s, and my parents were in their 70s, but still independent, generally healthy. That typically means for somebody in their 70s that they have a handful of chronic diseases, but those are reasonably well controlled and everything's going okay. Well, I was visiting with my folks and I hadn't seen them in a while, and I noticed that my dad's ankles were really swollen. And as you know, this is a symptom potentially of a fairly serious condition, congestive heart failure. And so I was a little bit worried about my dad, and I suggested that he go down to his physician at the Kaiser Health System, which is a very good, very well-organized, high-quality health system in general that receives very high marks, and have them check it out. Well, he did. So he listened to me about that. He went down there and they did a test to see that his heart was functioning just fine. So that was not the problem. But they said, oh, wow, your ankles really are very swollen. So what we're going to do is we're going to double the dose of the diuretic, the water pill you take for your hypertension. Well, as is often the case when you make a change in a medicine in an older adult, it wasn't very much longer. Next week or so, he started calling me back here in New York and saying that he was suddenly finding himself on the ground. He told me he wasn't passing out, but he just suddenly found himself on the ground. And I said, that's what passing out is like, Dad. And I said, you know, you should always be suspicious of the medications. And he said, well, I'll call them up and talk to them. And he did. And they said, oh, no, it can't possibly be the medications. A couple weeks go on, and he winds up being hospitalized for critically low blood pressure. And for a day or so, the people in the hospital are talking about some kind of liver problem, until somebody finally looks back in the medical record, as I've been begging him to do, and noticed the recent change in the diuretic dose and changed it back. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that not understanding your own health situation and not understanding even what your seemingly professional health provider may not know about care of older adults can lead people into very serious circumstances. And if you think about that, you know, multiplied by millions of older adults, if you fall enough, you can really hurt yourself. So there's nothing that other than luck that kept my dad from injuring himself in one of those falls or in the drive with critically low blood pressure down to the hospital. And if you multiply that by the millions, that's a lot of healthcare costs that are really being spent on fixing the mistakes of healthcare that doesn't know enough about caring for older people.
Right, right. You know, especially outpatient care, it's historically been done in very short intervals and very quickly. So I feel like it just requires such a mental shift for everybody. And I think even providers who perhaps want to do better often feel quite limited by time. And then it's true that they may not, if they haven't been trained in geriatrics, they may not think to consider the effect of overshooting on blood pressure and the effect that can have on falls. I think I have a link to it somewhere on the site, but at one point I saw a study that was of older adults who came to the emergency room for lightheadedness or passing out, and that by far the most useful diagnostic test, because they sort of took a look to see what kind of diagnostic tests were done, and all kinds of tests were done, but they found that one of the most useful ones was to just check blood pressure sitting and standing.
Right.
And notice the drop, but that it often was not done in the emergency room.
Nor in other settings. So, you know, that was my little story is an anecdote about, you know, my personal experience, but it actually does scale up. So national studies have been done of the quality of care of older adults, and I'm sure you're familiar with these as well, called the ACOVE studies, the acute care of assessing the care of vulnerable elders, which tried to look at whether that kind of very specific assessment or intervention was delivered to people for whom it was appropriate. So this issue of testing people's blood pressure when they're sitting or when they are lying down and then stand up is a very important assessment to understand why somebody might be falling, because the difference between those things might tell you whether somebody's getting lightheaded because they're standing up too quickly, or they have something else because perhaps too many medications. But it turns out that in cases where there is someone who has had a fall, several falls, that kind of lightheadedness, the actual process of conducting those two blood pressure checks is almost zero. And in fact, it's worse than it even sounds, because even good health systems are not doing it. But even when you try to train and modify the health systems to make that assessment, it doesn't happen. So it's something that telling us something about the not only is there an educational barrier between the way health professionals need to care for older adults, but as you're alluding to, there's a way that the system is misdesigned, that it doesn't allocate enough time, that there aren't the right personnel involved, that somehow perhaps the incentives are wrong, so that this kind of simple process, checking people's blood pressure two different ways, doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, a very important other piece of the puzzle, and something that Hartford worked on as well, is trying to improve education and training of health professionals. The other piece of work we did was to try to develop and disseminate new models of care that would make it easier to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those new models, and have any of them sort of expanded beyond the kind of initial pilot and sort of design phase?
So that's, I think, the key question. And going back to your earlier question, just so the audience understands, one of the things that foundations can do is to test on a small scale, a few million dollars, some kind of new idea for how to deliver care and to see if it works. And then perhaps if the foundation or the funder has the stick-to-itiveness to try to help it spread. But this issue of getting things to spread from a small demonstration to real life is a major problem that I've run into myself over and over again. But yes, there are a couple that have really spread pretty well. So one of which I'm very proud of started actually when I started at the foundation in 1997. We were trying to look at how people with depression were cared for. It turns out that depression isn't terribly more common in older adults than it is in younger adults. Being old isn't depressing. People who are older actually in many ways are mentally healthier than people who are younger. But nonetheless, people get depressed, and they can be depressed if they get sick, and if they lose loved ones, and those are things that happen. Mostly people go to their primary care provider, and the way most people are treated is with a prescription antidepressant. It turns out that that's not terribly effective. About 25% of people get better, significantly better, within 6 months or so. And that's actually not too much better than would happen even without treatment.
And I assume that's assuming the person also gets their symptoms followed up on after six right. weeks, which I find often doesn't happen. You know, the prescription is written, and, you know, later when I would see people, like, how long have you been on this? A year? Did they ever talk to you and, you know, about how you were doing, whether it should be raised or decreased? And no.
Exactly.
It's one of those things that often falls through the cracks, because I think in part because when older people come, they have other, you know, chronic conditions too. And clinicians often just pick three. Often, I think the three that are easiest to work on.
That's
and
exactly
you keep
it.
Deferring the rest until indefinitely. But
right.
anyway.
So the collaborative care model was intended to work exactly on that problem of poor follow-up. And poor follow-up leads to a failure to adjust medications. Antidepressants are a lot like antihypertension medicines. The chance of the first one working at the first dose that was tried is actually not very good. So you really have to expect to make some changes, to follow up, to see if somebody's all the way better. And so what the collaborative care model, which is now what it's called, does is exactly that. It puts a care manager, a nurse, or a social worker, or a psychologist on the team with the patient and the primary care provider, and enables that, gives that person tools to track and monitor and follow up, and even to provide some light therapy if the person either doesn't want to take medications or medications alone don't help them get better. So it doubles the effectiveness of usual care, which is not no care. It's just this issue of sort of ballistic prescribing. You fire off a prescription and who knows where it lands or what happens. So it's enormously more effective. And then we were able to demonstrate that in a very large randomized clinical trial, the sort of gold standard of testing across a wide variety of health systems and populations in the United States. And for almost 20 years thereafter, we've been working on this issue of getting it to spread. So we actually had, I think, reasonable success. There have been thousands of health professionals trained in the model, and hundreds of thousands of people across the country have been treated. Now, it's not all the way scaled up to be able to be offered to all the people who could benefit. But just last year, actually, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which runs the Medicare program, talked about making there a real benefit, a paid benefit, where Medicare would pay providers to use this model of care. And that is kind of the gold standard of dissemination. When you can get a model paid for, it's not the be-all and end-all of getting it to everybody, but it really, really helps.
Well, it certainly does help because, yeah, that seems to often be a big limitation. Yep. Because there you have an additional person in the clinic. And we actually had a social worker doing that when I was at the Over 60 Health Center in Berkeley, but that was a federally qualified health center. It was a community clinic for, you know, designed to serve mostly lower income community, although we had people of all income groups. And with that designation, they, I think, got some extra funds that they were able to apply to that program. And I think your story also gets at something that I often try to explain to people. People, you know, tell me, like, I want to find a good doctor. Where do I find a good doctor? And I tell them, well, you know, it's not just about the individual doctor. You want to find a clinic that is well organized and has infrastructure for, you know, that kind of has a plan internally for managing these common problems, whether they're falls or depression or just calling you back promptly to tell you about your lab results or something like that. Because people think that the healthcare they'll get is so dependent on the individual doctor. And really what that doctor is able to do is very powerfully influenced by the clinic structure. Mm-hmm. And that you can take somebody who, you know, is so-so, or maybe hasn't even been trained in geriatrics. And if you put them in an environment where doing these right things is enabled and made easier, instead of requiring the doctor to, one, think of it, do, and two, do a lot of extra work trying to make it happen, that's really often better. But people tend to think that your healthcare is going to depend on how great your doctor was in terms of bedside manner and the education they got. And that's really only part of the story, I think.
I very much agree with you, Leslie. And I am, in fact, at this point in my career, torn between the issue of whether it's more knowledge and skills needed in the heads of a few health professionals or whether it's a reorganization and redesign of the way the average provider works. And we actually did a poll that came out in 2014 on this issue because it's, I think, important to understand how people understand this. So again, we replicated this notion that people were very satisfied with their doctors. And most doctors work in, still today, in small practices without a lot of those resources. So they were satisfied, even though they probably weren't getting a lot of that quality, coordinated team care that a better organized practice can deliver. But then again, what we did was we walked them through all the different kinds of things that an organized practice can deliver that an individual practitioner working by him or herself can't do. So, for example, reminder calls, following up on things like how you're responding to a medication, whether that's an antidepressant or an antihypertensive, it's, the recommendations are frequently that somebody should be called or called in a couple of weeks after a new prescription to see how it's going. But that process of just calling people in, or even just calling them and talking to them, oftentimes doesn't happen. So we could track through those kinds of key processes, reminding people, following up on side effects and intended effects of new treatments, whether there would be access to medical records if someone turned up in the hospital for some reason, so connectivity to other parts of the healthcare system. And the interesting thing was that very, very few older adults reported getting any of these kind of enhanced systematic care services. About 20% said that they got that kind of team coordinated high quality care. But what people said was that they thought that that would be really helpful to them, and they thought it would improve their health. And the people who were fortunate enough to actually be receiving that kind of care corroborated that and said, yes, they thought that that was contributing to their good health and well-being right now. So we saw this as very strong endorsement from people as we sort of explained the concepts of team care, that people would like to have it, and they thought it would be things that would be important to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that you've sort of been torn between, you know, is it more important to create more education and expertise, or to provide more sort of structure in the clinic environment? But I think along with those two, those are both very focused on the providers. But as you can imagine, I've for the past few years been thinking, well, we can also provide some of that education and knowledge to older adults and families directly, so that they might be able to ask, how about checking my parents' blood pressure sitting and standing? And then I've also, you know, found myself wondering, well, if you have all these chronic conditions, you know, is there a way that we can help individuals keep track of their conditions? So for instance, you know, if you're diagnosed with depression and they prescribe something, to what extent should we encourage people to, you know, make a note for themselves? Let me check in with my doctor about it in 2 months. And in the past, when I've talked to people in healthcare quality, I feel like people are a little bit torn, because on one hand, they feel that we shouldn't be imposing more responsibility and burden on patients and families who often already have their hands full with their lives, with their illnesses. For family caregivers, they're often working, juggling other responsibilities. And here we are telling them, well, you know, we tend to forget about these things, so how about you work on remembering them? And so I agree that it's, you know, it's too bad to sort of ask people to do more. And at the same time, you know, I feel like ultimately there are some people who want to know what they can do to take better care of their health or of their parents' health. And in the end, that's the person who has the most stake in the care getting better, is the patient and the family. So I feel like it's another angle that we can work on, is to provide some support to help people be as proactive as possible for their health, and also, you know, potentially to ask for these things from their providers, which might help motivate the providers to get better at providing those things.
I agree entirely. And I think there are two things, really. There's the general information that your podcast, I think, is a good example of, trying to educate the public in ways that people can understand about some of the issues that they'll be facing in care of themselves or their loved ones, their family members around aging, and to be more sophisticated and more demanding, frankly, about it. The other thing, I think, is arming people with specific tools and knowledge and reminders and things that could be IT but could just be on paper around specific care. So one good example of this that is another innovation that Hartford was successful in getting to spread actually is coaching people around the transition out of the hospital and back to the home. So one of the things that was discovered, actually, although people have known this for a long time, is that almost 20% of Medicare beneficiaries, older adults, wind up back in the hospital within 30 days of being discharged. And this is often because they didn't quite understand how they're supposed to care for themselves. They didn't get the medications right, either not necessarily because of any fault of their own. They may have been given the wrong medications or had their prescriptions adjusted incorrectly, but in the hospital or on the way out of the hospital. In any event, 20% of people wind up back in the hospital within 30 days. And the intervention, the innovation that we were able to develop and then help spread was to have a nurse come and coach people to help them understand for themselves and for their loved ones what to expect, what the medications were for and how to take them, what not to be taking anymore that might be a leftover prescription in the medicine cabinet, and also how to be assertive in dealing with the healthcare system around questions and problems so as to not let them fester and lead to something that would require going back to the hospital. And that worked quite well. It was able to reduce people's need to go back to the hospital, which is good for people and families, and saves money.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially now that hospitals are being penalized for readmissions. I think
that's
it's really
right.
Been in many ways a boon, because now hospitals have a real interest in
right.
these programs that ensure that people are better prepared and equipped for that transition to home and giving them a way to call or ask questions.
In fact, the Affordable Care Act set aside $500 million to support this transition coaching model across the country. It later was scaled back a little bit. But nonetheless, not only are there penalties that are making hospitals interested in it, but there are incentive funds. But the broader point I wanted to try to address is that I think we've all been very tentative for a lot of reasons around trying to get people to be more demanding about their care and to be better educated about what to demand. On the one hand, yes, we've been very concerned about putting more burden on people and their family members. The whole notion of people being discharged from hospitals, as they say, quicker and sicker, clearly puts a burden on people. But even people being in the hospital is really burdensome. In fact, if you would ask people, you know, what's a stressor, having a loved one in the hospital is incredibly stressful. And I think any tools you can give to help people get some control over that process is a good thing. And I think this is probably not something that I'm very proud of, but certainly at the beginning of my career, we were also very diffident about giving people tools and expectations for fear of seeming to be ungrateful to the healthcare system. So we
right.
we told people, we didn't arm the general public with expectations around what their depression care or their geriatric care should be in general, because we didn't want them going to their regular primary care provider, family physician, internist with all this long list of things and, I don't know, getting into a fight with them. But looking back, I think that was wrong. People need to ask for what they deserve. And our health, it's sort of a paradox. We're very proud of healthcare in the United States in general, and it does many things really well. But it doesn't provide good quality chronic care to older adults. And it won't until we start being really demanding about it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's tough because there is, you know, in a way it's a sort of a diplomacy issue. And I have had, you know, especially geriatric care managers who often just through doing their work have become savvier than the average person in knowing things to ask about. But many of them have told me how they get pushback from providers when they speak up and ask about things. And they hear things like, well, did you go to medical school? And I'm almost left thinking that I think doctors are less likely to give pushback to families and patients than to other professionals who they see as, you know, sort of less than them. But of course, patients and families have plenty of stories also of doctors being very dismissive or brushing off their concerns. And I think, I remember, you know, I was just really, I guess, kind of finishing medical school and starting residency when health information became quite widely available on the internet. And so I remember those early days when there was a lot of discomfort in the medical profession with patients coming in with information that they had read, and that suddenly there were other ways for them to get information. and ask for things, and that providers often felt it was a big hassle. Now, having been in that position, some of the things people bring me, are not great quality and do generate a lot of extra time explaining why it's not appropriate. But I think the sort of the fundamental idea that we should be open to people bringing in additional information and kind of learning about their health, and that our role should be to support them in managing their health rather than just doing things to them and expecting them to, kind of go along passively for the ride. I think we're moving towards that, but it's definitely a cultural transition for healthcare providers. And then I think also difficult when it's pointed out that they've been prescribing something that's on the list of things that are not very good for older adults. And, I think one can understand how that's uncomfortable.
Yes. And I think what we all know from the quality improvement movement overall is that oftentimes it actually begins with being uncomfortable. When people look at the quality of care they're delivering through, say, a chart review of what they've been doing, oftentimes people are very disappointed. Oftentimes they start out denying that it's even true. I didn't do that. It couldn't be true. But the process then moves on to, how did that happen and how can I fix it? So I think there are a lot of hard truths. Perfectly well-meaning, well-trained professionals in many ways don't do as good a job as they think they do, and they need to be more receptive to all kinds of feedback. They need to, our health system needs to learn from its own process in a better way so that it can be more focused on delivering results and high-quality care. And the health professions and the health system needs to be more focused on the input of patients and families. I think the way I sort of think about it is, yes, one's physician is the expert in human biology and disease in general, but people are the experts on themselves in lots of ways. And so, in my own personal experience, that kind of dismissiveness oftentimes is wrong and oftentimes leads to sort of embarrassing outcomes. And one has to be careful in both ways. Certainly as a layperson, I sometimes ask for the wrong thing or ask the wrong questions. But sometimes I'm right too.
Right. No, absolutely. So we're certainly working on enabling physicians to, one, be more receptive to extra input and ideas from their patients, and two, to learn more geriatrics. And then at the Hartford, you did focus a lot on trying to expand the geriatrics workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think are the most promising approaches currently for doing this? We have sort of 7,000 geriatricians, and it seems unlikely that we're going to expand that number soon. So when people tell you, what are we going to do about the shortage of geriatricians? What do you find promising right now to work on?
Well, as you know, because you were one of the authors, actually just guest edited a special issue of the journal entitled Generations, which is the magazine published by the American Society on Aging on just this workforce issue. And while there are a lot of good suggestions, my experience over the last 20 years basically suggests that we've been going about it the wrong way. We've been trying to expand the number of geriatricians and, by the way, also expand the number of geriatric specialists in nursing and in social work at the same time with very little success, because basically the economics and the social demand are against this. So as a large private funder, but still nowhere near the size one would need to really be influential across the healthcare system that represents 18% of gross domestic product, we were kind of trying to push with a wet noodle. So we were trying to push something uphill with a wet noodle, and it doesn't work. What I think is a much more promising avenue right now is that, given that it's finally the time when there are some real incentives to deliver better care to people, so to keep them out of the hospital, rather than hospitals wanting to have all of their beds filled and not really minding if somebody comes back within 30 days, now hospitals want to keep some beds empty. They don't want to see people coming back And if geriatric expertise, whether that's in nursing or in medicine or in social work, can help that happen, then it really is valuable in a in an economic, monetary way, as well as to the limited number of patients that they can see directly, so that this expertise can then be put to work in system redesign. So to given we only have 7,000 geriatricians, there's no way that they can care for even a fraction of the 40 million older adult Medicare beneficiaries that are out there right now, much less the ones that are coming. So what we have to have those geriatricians do is things beyond their own direct clinical care that helps the average provider and the average older adult take better care of themselves. So we need to harness that expertise in a different way. So, I mean, there's good news, bad news. The good news is I think geriatric expertise is more valuable than ever. But the bad news is that it's not going to be geriatricians who deliver that expertise in one-on-one clinical care. The numbers just don't work, and we haven't been able to make them work.
Right. Well, you were mentioning the hospital, and, you know, one example. And Hartford may have been involved in this work, but, you know, was developing special units for the hospital care of older adults. They were originally called acute care for elders units, ACE units, where they sort of redesign a hospital wing and train the nursing staff and other staff in better supporting the health of the older person while they're hospitalized. They have, fewer wake-ups during the night because actually being sleep-deprived makes it hard to recover. And when you're younger, you tolerate that better. But when you're older, you don't. They help older adults get, you know, mobilized in the room early. They're very attentive to diagnosing delirium, that condition of worse than usual mental function that often affects older people in hospitals. And I think that's a nice example of how such a unit leverages geriatric expertise. It takes all the things that our field has learned about optimizing the healthcare of an older person in the hospitalization. But once you've sort of set it up and trained people, even though many such units are overseen by geriatricians, you know, most of the people delivering care are not geriatricians. And so I think that's, you know, kind of an example of setting up a program or a structure that uses the knowledge base and doesn't depend on every single provider being trained in geriatrics.
That is exactly right, and a very good example. The acute care of elders unit is something that the foundation helped get started. Seth Landefeld, who was the director of geriatrics at UCSF.
I know, he hired me as a fellow.
Back when he was in Cleveland, he did that research, and then many of those ideas around the ACE unit have been spread by other programs, including NICHE, Nurses Improving the Care of Hospitalized Elders. So ACE begat NICHE, which begat, you know, somehow it feels somewhat biblical to me. But those are good examples of the kind of redesign efforts that can help even generalist health professionals deliver much better quality care. And one of the other things I think that's important about this observation is that it's actually better care for everybody. So an ACE unit is particularly important to an older adult because of this issue of less reserve and being more affected by things like being woken up in the middle of the night too many times, not getting enough food, or getting disoriented because of sensory deprivation. One of the things that ACE units sometimes do is just make a special effort to be sure that people keep their hearing aids, their glasses, and their teeth, which are oftentimes lost in the shuffle in a regular hospital unit, but are really important, as you might imagine, to keeping somebody fed and oriented to where they are and what's going on. So simple little things can make a big difference. And yet, it would make a hospital stay better for you and me, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Well, so I guess that's, you know, one of the recommendations that you know, we can make for the listeners is to know that there are programs, you know, within hospitals or clinics developed for better care for older adults, and you can sort of look and ask for them. And so sometimes I tell people, well, if it's an elective surgery or if you have a choice, find out if the hospital has an ACE unit. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, write them a letter and say, I think you should have one. It'll help motivate them to do it. Or, you know, take your business as a surgery patient to one of these hospitals that does offer that, because it has been studied and did show much better outcomes.
Right. And that's, I think, another direction of care that the foundation is working on now, even after I've left, is to find ways to partner our scarce geriatric expertise in areas that it's really important. So there's a geriatric emergency room movement that's quite successful and growing pretty rapidly right now. And the foundation is working along with the Gary and Mary West Foundation from California. Another area is in the surgical area, around quality surgical care for older adults. While older people are still only 13-14% of the population, they are something like 40% of the population who are receiving many surgical procedures. And yet, this is something that surgery hasn't focused on enough specifically, the needs and the special issues around caring for this big section of their patient population. And then lastly, in the very specific area of orthopedic surgery, hip replacements, which are overwhelmingly older adults, this is another high opportunity to marry scarce geriatric expertise with orthopedic surgeons and their teams for the care of a population who are oftentimes really frail, because breaking a hip is a real sentinel event, a marker of something going wrong with somebody's life.
Yeah, no, certainly. So it's great that there's work in building the geriatrics abilities of these other specialties and areas in medicine. And I think also, if patients and families ask for it, which partly starts with them realizing that geriatrics exists, mm-hmm. as basically, an approach that's a little different than what you would do for somebody who is, 40s, 50s, 60s, something like that. I mean, I've often said that when people tell me that, doctors tell me they practice geriatrics because all their patients now are in their 80s, I sort of think, well, yes, but if you're still doing the same thing that you were doing when they were 50, then it's not quite right.
Right.
So, but I think it's growing. There's actually been more media stories about geriatrics and geriatricians. So I think the public's awareness of it is growing, but I think helping them also realize that that can be brought to emergency rooms, as you were saying, and surgery is super important. Well, I want to... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to make a joke. The famous geriatrician, the founder of the National Institute on Health, Bob Butler, who was actually a geriatric psychiatrist, used to say that treating a lot of older adults doesn't make you a geriatrician any more than treating people who have hearts makes you a cardiologist. And so this notion, I think, that many health professionals have, that they see a lot of older adults and therefore they're really good at their care, is just a non sequitur. And I would turn that around to your point about the public, which is why I think this podcast and others like it are so important. And that is, people need to know what to ask for. And I think we will have won when people know, like they do now when they have cancer, they know they want an oncologist to help them. People need to have that same certainty and that same demand that if they're older and they have a complex health problem, they need a geriatrician, or at least they need geriatric expertise overseeing their care in some way. And when people are as demanding about that as they are about oncologist and cancer care, then we will have succeeded. And probably at that point, then the geriatric workforce will begin to grow.
Right. Well, cardiology is an interesting example, because that is actually a field where every internist and family practice doctor, every generalist is expected to have basic competency in it and to be able to do the first pass, and then to refer or get help if you need to. And also, really importantly, we all rotate through cardiology in residency, and learn it from cardiologists. And I think so far, even though the work, I believe, of the Hartford Foundation and of others, have helped bring more geriatric rotations and courses to medical education for medical students and for residents, I think it's still not yet required to do a rotation in geriatrics for internists.
It's actually worse than that. It used to be required, and then it got unrequired.
So that is just, do you think that's going to change? us. It just seems astounding given the aging of the population and the fact that older adults are just disproportionately represented in primary care clinics and in hospitals.
So I think that it represents, essentially an institutional discrimination within medicine, looking down on geriatrics. I mean, I think you probably know that lots of fellows who choose geriatrics will tell you that they were oftentimes argued with by their mentors. Why would you want to do that? Is a very common question people report having gotten. Or, I thought you were smart. Why are you doing that? Geriatric care, while in some ways it's the most complicated care of people who have complex illness, who have important trade-offs in terms of goals and preferences for care and what's possible for them at a time of incredible stress and difficulty, oftentimes in the last years of their life. I mean, in my view, that takes a super physician, a super clinician, and yet we give an awful lot of credit and an awful lot of admiration to people who are in very technical fields with a lot of technological interventions like cardiology, and don't give as much respect to something that I think is really important, like geriatric care.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, to just bring up another specialty analogy, I often find myself thinking about the early days of pediatrics. Because, you know, the other way in which geriatrics is a little bit different from oncology, cancer care, or cardiology is that it's less about an organ or disease type and more about a person at a certain life stage. And so, you know, I sort of wonder if in the early days of pediatrics, you know, you had all the doctors saying, ah, kids, you know, I already take care of kids. You know, I mean, what's so special about kids? They're, you know, they're small adults or they're like adults, but smaller. And children do have all the same organs, many of the same diseases, but, you know, they require a modification in approach, both because the sort of diseases and physiology is different. And also because when you take care of a child, you know, the parents, you know, there's this whole family involved. And likewise, when you care for older adults, there's often, you know, family and other people involved as well. And so sometimes I sort of wonder how long it took for people to really appreciate pediatrics as this sort of valid knowledge base. And we expect family medicine doctors to, one, train in pediatrics, to deliver that care when they see a child.
And I think that's a shrewd observation and a really important analogy. And I've actually looked into it because of that. And what one finds historically is the field of pediatrics evolved long before there actually was a lot of specialized knowledge of the care of children. And it really represents a societal shift in the early 1900s to recognize the importance of children and that this is something that society wanted to invest in and to mark as being especially important, probably as some of the deaths due to infectious disease was already beginning to come down, society was beginning to be able to think about children as something it wanted to invest in and to mark as special. Mm. And so pediatrics began without the evidence base, without really understanding what the differences in physiology were. And geriatrics is just not there. In fact, when I've talked to, say, family docs who are trained to care for the whole age range, they would say, oh, you know, the physiology and the differences in the way medications are metabolized are as different between older adults, 80s and 90s, and younger adults as younger adults are different from children. It's not the absolute difference in physiology. It's something about the social meaning that we haven't quite been able to capture in the care of older adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad you brought up that point. And that's really interesting, actually. I hadn't been aware of that. But in the time we have left, I wanted to ask you about this Reframing Aging report, because in your position at the Hartford Foundation, you were the chair of the board for Grantmakers in Aging. And they helped spearhead this project, which I mentioned on a recent podcast episode. But I would love for you to tell us more about it, because I thought it was so interesting, the Reframing Aging work done by Frameworks. So can you tell us a bit about it, the genesis for the project, and what they found so far in doing
Absolutely.
That work.
Absolutely. And this gets at this point about how society understands an issue like aging. And by that understanding, potentially gives us tools to change the way that's understood. So just to back up, I think this is a wonderful project, and I was really pleased to be able to support it both as the board chair of Grantmakers and Aging, which is sort of the coordinating body for this activity, and while I was still back at the John A. Hartford Foundation. In fact, it's something why didn't I do this before? The Frameworks Institute is a communications research enterprise, a nonprofit, that has looked at a wide variety of social issues. One of actually is children, the way people think about child development. And they use good cognitive science, communications research techniques to understand how the public in general understands an issue so as to be able to reframe and reshape the public understanding in a way that's better for society and for the groups that are being considered. So let me give you a concrete example. One of the things they've worked on is early childhood environment. What they found 15 years ago was that if you talked about a toxic childhood environment, people often said things like, well, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. And there really wasn't any understanding about how an overly stressful, toxic environment with violence and poverty could disadvantage someone for the rest of their lives. And in fact, some of the messages that people gave out about why we need to take better care of children and give them better environments worked against any policy change in that area because it triggered ideas about being exposed to challenges and then overcoming them and becoming stronger by virtue of doing that. So Frameworks was able to uncover some of those fundamental assumptions, the way the public frames that kind of issue, and then in coalition with other partners work for many years to change that understanding so that we now have, I think, a much more serious understanding that to be the just and equitable society, kids need an even chance. It's just not right for some people to kind of be born disadvantaged and not have any way of making it up. Now, in the older adult case, what we're finding is that people have two understandings of aging. One is incredibly positive. I think of it as the barefoot water skier. If you've been through an airport, oftentimes there's a poster of some older gentleman water skiing, and they may have fixed his hip a few weeks before, and he looks terribly happy. And it's just unrealistic. And people know that level is unrealistic. And then you've got a sort of secret understanding of aging, which is really scarier than it needs to be. It's the person in the nursing home. It's the person with dementia. And so the public understanding has this deep ambivalence, an unattainable ideal that people don't think they can really have, or something that's just too scary to talk about, and not a lot of middle ground. And so that's what the Frameworks Initiative has discovered so far, is that really as a society, we're not mature enough to think seriously about aging. And so the counter messages are something that they're working on right now. So by analogy, how did you overcome that assumption that a toxic environment was actually good for people? So how do we get people to understand that the vast majority of older adults are well, independent, but need perhaps some special and reasonable accommodations to help them maintain that health and independence? That's what Frameworks is working on right now.
Yeah. And just to add to that, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about their report, although I wasn't surprised by it, was that they said that people had this very individual responsibility view of aging, that the people who did well or who were doing well, you know, even as they aged into their late 80s or their 90s, that it was because they had made good choices, and that the people who did less well, you know, must have made poor choices somewhere. And I say I'm not surprised because I think Americans in general tend to gravitate to this idea that, you know, that you have a huge influence over your fate, and that, you know, if things didn't work out well, then you didn't work hard enough. And, you know, if things did work out well for you, well, it's because, you know, you were deserving or you did hard work. Whereas a lot of the, you know, research, including on childhood adversity that you were mentioning, is that the environments and the societal supports we have a really powerful effect on how we do later on. And so I remember in the report, they sort of commented that because people think your aging experience is so much about, you know, the choices you made as an individual, they don't really understand why making certain policy changes or societal supports is very important.
That's right. And you have it right. I think that their analysis at the Frameworks Institute is that as Americans, our default assumption across a wide variety of issues is around personal responsibility. And I don't think, you know, that there's anything wrong with personal responsibility, but obviously, like anything, it can be exaggerated. So the notion that when you've achieved your 80s and 90s, that if you're sick, it's your fault, I mean, I think realistically is just wrong. When people live long enough, they're going to accumulate illnesses. And we need a healthcare system that can, on the one hand, do a better job of preventing that happening as people live into more and more live into their 80s and 90s, but can also help those people who make it into their 80s and 90s cope with those illnesses more effectively. And so that's the kind of change that I'm hoping that they can give us the tools to help push forward. Now, I think one important observation is from the analogy of the childhood adversity is that there are no magic wands. And this is a communications campaign that will take years to push forward. It's the right thing to do. It's the only thing to do. I think it's a key issue to try to address the challenges of providing high-quality health care to older adults that we've been discussing. But it's going to take some perseverance, which fortunately is another American preference and value. So we're going to have to work hard and long on this, but I think we can be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's great that they're doing the work. And I'm hoping that since the number of older people is increasing, that we'll have more of these sort of substantive conversations as a society about, you know, the kind of middle ground in aging and the need to support people. I mean, even for chronic illnesses, I feel like overwhelmingly people posit the solution, which is that, well, you have to sort of have healthy behaviors and prevent them. And that's a very important part of preventing them. You can have healthy behaviors. It also helps if your community is walkable, so you walk more. But I feel like once people have the illness, there's a lot that they can be doing to keep it from progressing as quickly, and that their ability to do that is partly dependent on our ability as a healthcare system to support them in doing it. And often we're not very good at supporting people in doing that. So I feel like it's not just about preventing the illnesses, but that at every stage, there are ways that we can help people manage their health better or help compensate for whatever difficulty they're having so that they don't decline as quickly and don't spiral. But people tend to think that, well, either you need to prevent it from happening or, you know, it's too late. That's right. And that's just a shame because I feel like in geriatrics, we work in that after things have happened, but it's never too late.
That's right.
Space. And I think, well, you might remember, but for a while when Robert Wood Johnson was doing the culture of health, I felt like there was a lot of focus on keeping people healthy, which is important, but that many people, especially in their later years, spend a certain amount of time, you know, in a way that you could label they're not healthy and that they have chronic illnesses, chronic impairments, and that's when it's really important for us to be involved in supporting them so that they can always be making the most of their health and well-being and ability to participate in life.
That's right. And that's the kind of all or nothing thinking we need to get out of. People aren't all healthy or all sick. We're all on a journey. We're all, you know, aging, and we're all going to die at some point. And we need to be sensible and realistic and make the best choices we can, but also get the best care when our own physiology catches up with us. So
right, which partly means finding the right help and then maybe supporting policies and changes that make that help more available to more people. So in closing, can you share a couple thoughts, just takeaways for the audience on what you think is most important for older adults and their families to know and do when it comes to taking care of themselves or improving their health and making the changes that we need over the next several years.
So I think, I'm sure you've covered in other podcasts, I know you have, probably the number one thing that people can do for themselves is physical activity. If there is any panacea out there, of course, it's being more physically active. And that can just start with walking or doing exercises while seated in a chair while watching television. Every little bit helps. I think the next thing that we've spent a lot of time talking about is knowing what to ask for. There is a real body of expertise out there around care of older adults, care of people with multiple chronic illnesses and things that aren't going to be cured by some high-tech intervention but need to be managed. And so ask for it, look for it, and value it. And then lastly, I think to understand that the healthcare team and the quality of care you get is not just about a heroic figure who swoops in with some esoteric knowledge, but whether your healthcare team acts like a team, does all the simple little things on a reliable and regular basis that it's going to take to help you maximize your health and independence over your 30 years of older adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are some great suggestions. Well, Chris, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to sort of seeing what philanthropy and health brings us next and what projects you take on in the future.
Thank you.
So I hope you all enjoyed those insights from Chris Langston. Again, he is the former program director of the John A. Hartford Foundation and has worked at the intersection of aging, health, and philanthropy for the past 20 years. For links related to this episode's discussion, be sure to visit the show notes page for this episode. You can find that at betterhealthwhileaging.net/podcast, and that will take you to a list of recent episodes, including this one. And of course, if you have any questions about something you heard in this episode, please post your question in the comments section under the show notes for the episode. Last but not least, if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to support us. You can do this by subscribing on iTunes, and if you've already done that, please leave a rating and review. You can also support us by spreading the word and telling people who might enjoy the podcast about it. All of this makes it easier for others to discover our show on iTunes, and I would love for the many people who are interested in health or aging or family caregivers to find it and give it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, and I'm looking forward to you joining us for future episodes.